So welcome everybody to the session in today's Yarchei Kala. I'd just like to share with you a very memorable experience. When I was in elementary school, the Hebrew Academy of Greater Miami, so they invited a guest speaker to come, and it was the most excitement I'd ever seen. Parents actually took off from work. I remember my parents specifically taking off from work to come and hear the guest speaker. It was a woman by the name of Meep Geese.
Oh, she was Anne.
Right, so Meep Geese was the woman, the Dutch woman, who helped hide Anne Frank and her family in the attic. And I remember her coming into school. I was in elementary school, but it still made an impression. She was a short woman, a Lilliputian type of woman. But after, you know, having been prepared, after having read Anne Frank's diary, and then actually seeing the heroine of the story, Meep Geese, come in to speak, it was such a powerful moment. And you saw that history is actually alive. It's not just about books and footnotes in a book and endnotes. It's actually living people, people who went through such terrible times and really stood out as real heroes. So for me, that was a very inspiring moment, even as a young child, getting the chance, the opportunity, the zchus, the merit, to meet such a hero. Now, the people we will be focusing on today are also heroes. Certainly, they were giants in the Torah world, but more specifically, they were heroes. The Mishnah in Avos tells us that al shlosha dvarim ha'olam omed, that there are three pillars that hold up the world. They are the pillars al ha-Torah, al ha-Avoda, v'al gemilus chasadim. Torah, Avoda is service, and kindness, a gemilus chasadim. I'd like to take just a few minutes, 45 minutes, to focus on the three characters the three personalities we're going to focus in on today, who really sustain the world as the devastation of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, was turning the world upside down. They served as the pillars to keep the world from total destruction. And again, it would take us days, perhaps months, to really give the full attention needed to the characters that we're going to talk about. And these are only three amongst, you know, many, many, many great heroes of the Holocaust. But I thought these three figures serve as perfect models of the pillars of Torah, Avoda of service, and Gemilus Chasadim. Now, many of the ideas and a lot of information I got, just as a brief word of introduction, I'm going to be pointing out a few beautiful works that are very worthwhile if you have a chance to read or get your hands on. So a lot of the information that I got for today's class is actually from a wonderful work called Hidden in Thunder, written by Esther Farbstein. So it's a tremendous work. Esther Farbstein is actually interesting, is the wife of one of the leading Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, the Rosh Yeshiva of Hebron, a prominent Rosh Yeshiva, and it's interesting that she, I guess, was working on a thesis, a doctorate, and she wrote this whole work on perspectives of faith, halacha, and leadership during the Holocaust. It was published by Mossad Rav Kook. It's really a tremendous work, two volumes, with really beautiful insights, and really deep and profound insights into the life and times of those who led during the Holocaust. So again, I'm sure, I think they have it.
So just for the school, Aaron and Sarah Mountain, where Sarah was here, they sponsored the English translation.
Oh, okay, very nice. Right, it was originally written in Hebrew, and then it was translated into English.
Very vocal, and I want
to... Oh, okay, thank you so much. So if you know them, you can give them a yashikov. So we'll begin today by talking about Torah. Now, the personality, the pillar of Torah that I'd like to focus in on was Ephraim Oshri. Ephraim Oshri was born in 1914 in Kupiskis, Lithuania. Now, he had the opportunity to be a Talmud and a colleague of one of the leading Torah giants of the time, Rav Avram Dov Ber Kahana Shapiro, who was known as the Kovna Rav. He was the rabbi of Kovna. Now, since Rav Oshri had the opportunity to live in Kovno, unfortunately in 1941, when the Nazis invaded Kovno was in Lithuania, the capital of Lithuania, he was placed in the Kovno ghetto and the surrounding concentration camps. There had been forts that had been built, I guess in the 1800s, the 1700s, Fort 9 specifically, which was right in the vicinity of Kovno, and the Nazis turned that into a concentration camp. So Rav Oshri was with Rav Shapiro, the Kovna Rav, in the Kovno ghetto, and in the concentration camp. And while they were there, so the Kovna Rav, Rav Avram Shapiro, he passed away of natural causes in the ghetto, but he was the leading Torah personality in that area. And people would come to him with shilos, as they would in normal times, although the questions they were asking certainly didn't reflect, reflected the times that were certainly not normal. And Rav Oshri, as the right-hand man of the Kovno Rav, and then after the death as the leading posek in the Kovno ghetto and concentration camp, He wrote down those tshuvos. He wrote down those questions that were asked during this terrible period of the Holocaust, of the Shoah. And he hid them in cans and he buried them. And after he was miraculously saved, after the liberation, at the end of the war, he came back to Kovno and he dug up these questions. And he went on to live. He moved to the Bronx. He lived in New York. He only passed away, I believe, in the 80s, the 1980s in the Bronx. And he made it his mission after the Holocaust to take those tshuvos that he had written up shorthand and the questions and answers he had been presented with while he was in the Kovno ghetto, and he wrote them up into what we have here is the Shailos u'tshuvos mimamakim, the responsa from the depths. Really, mimamakim has a connotation of really the depths of hell. And this was just unbelievable work. You shudder to even pick up the sefer and read through some of the questions, and just to think what they were presenting their Rebbeim, the Kovno Rav and Rav Oshri in the ghetto and in the concentration camp. And it's very beautiful. They actually wrote in English a translation of a select number of the tshuvos called Responsa from the Holocaust. And this is really a beautifully written sefer. I call it a sefer, even though it's written in English. It's really a sefer. It's really a very deep sefer. If you have the opportunity to get your hands on it, it's really very just motivational and inspiring just to see the types of questions and the way he responds to the halachic quandaries of the time. So today I'd like to focus in on two shilohs. One is a very quick question, and one is a little more in depth, just to see the type of halacha that we're dealing with in the ghetto and in the concentration camp. So if you turn to page number one, we'll read the first one in English. The first one in English, again, a halachic question. A halachic question, number 26, taken from Responsa from the Holocaust. Question, 1942. I was asked by the people in the Kovno ghetto whether they might fulfill the mitzvah of lighting Shabbos candles by using electric lights, and whether they may recite the blessing Lahadlik Ner Shel Shabbos on those lights. They wanted to know in the ghetto. They didn't have the opportunity to get their hands on candles, imagine. But they still were so concerned about lighting Shabbos licht that they wanted to know, could they use electrical lights and make a bracha? People who all their lives had been careful to fulfill the mitzvah were unable to obtain candles because of the very fact that they were locked up in the ghetto. Electricity, however, was available. So that's the question. Can they use electrical lights? And the response, he writes, I ruled... Now again, just interesting, in the English version, so he cuts through a lot of the analysis and the pilpul, and he gets right down to the point of the halacha. He says that I ruled that where it is impossible under any circumstances to obtain Shabbos candles, it is permissible to recite the blessing on electric lighting. Similarly, one may recite the blessing Borei Me'orei Ha'esh on an electric bulb upon the termination of Shabbos. Yes.
Presented as this Rav's tshuva to a shayla. Where did my father get it?
That it was permissible.
Yes, I always assumed he was telling me something that was well known, that was generally accepted. And now I realize no.
That it, right. So
did your father live in that period or after that?
Yes, but he was in America.
But maybe
during
the other
time.
So it could be. It could be that in America. So maybe it was more of a discussion based on, again, the cultural, maybe a different culture at the time. It could be in Kovno, they had never, it seems from the questions, they had never even thought to deal with this question. Right? Living in Europe, maybe they never even had the what we call the havamina, the thought entered their mind to have to deal with lighting Shabbos candles when they didn't have candles. Also, you have to realize that the people who were gathered in the ghetto represented a large spectrum across the board of all different types of Jews. They were herded into a ghetto. So it could be that some were a little more educated than others. And if they were presented with a shaila that maybe in their shtetl they never had to deal with before, I don't even know whether or not they had electricity in all the shtetls. Again, this is conjecture, but certainly, they never had to deal with lighting electrical candles. I can imagine that in Europe it wasn't, especially in that area, in Lithuania, maybe the small suburbs of Kovno, maybe they never had to deal with such an issue. And for them, it was certainly a novel halacha. And in the Sefer, he has to give the pratim the more specifics about the reason why. Now, it could be, again, I don't know, maybe your father had already asked the question. Maybe in America it was already a question that had been dealt with. Right? But certainly in the Kovno ghetto, they felt that this was a pressing halachic matter. And it happens to be a big halachic discussion whether or not electricity, especially then in the 40s, I would assume that a lot of the issues pertaining to electricity and halacha, they hadn't been dealt with so much at the time. It was still pretty cutting edge, discussions. We think of cutting edge halachic discussions now as dealing with all sorts of high tech. But at the time, it wasn't as, I guess, widespread, especially in Europe, I would assume, in those little towns.
Is Rav Ashman recording what Rav Shapiro said, or what he...
So, I think Rav Shapiro had already passed away by 1942. So, some of the earlier tshuvas had been presented to Rav Shapiro. So, you have to get the timeline of when exactly Rabbi Shapiro passed away. So that some of the tshuvas beforehand were responded to by Rabbi Shapiro, and Rav Oshri just happened to record them, and some of them were after the death of the Kovno Rav, so Rav Oshri took over as the posek in the Kovno ghetto. Now the next tshuva, to me, happens to be just, we can't even fathom the question being asked, and certainly the story behind it and the response. We have it in English, but if you don't mind, if you turn to page 3, you can follow in English, or I'd like to read it in Hebrew just because it has with it some of the beauty of the original writing of the tshuva. So he says, it's Shaila Vav in this chelak of the Shailos HaTshuvos Mimamakim. He says, the Shaila, right, after the title. He says, the question was asked, B'choref Shnat Tavshin Beis, in the winter of 1942, Kama Chadoshim Lufnei Chag HaPesach, it was a number of months before the holiday of Pesach, Hayinu Achra Yimei HaChanukah, we're talking about the time after Chanukah. Some of the people who had been gathered, herded into the ghetto, lachshov machshavos v'lidog, they began to worry. Already after Chanukah, they started thinking, what's going to be when it comes a few months, it's going to be Pesach, how are we going to fulfill the mitzvah of matzah? At the time in the ghetto, we certainly didn't have any sustenance, any food. Certainly we didn't have any white flour. Who a little play on words. He says we couldn't, you know, on Pesach there's an iser, a violation that we can't, we can't find chametz. Right? And he says certainly in the ghetto, there's bayirah, bayimatzah, we couldn't find flour to make the matzah. Those who were in the ghetto were sustained by whatever that came to their hand. He said, whatever black bread we were given in the ghetto certainly wasn't enough to sustain our hunger. V'agermanim harurim, the cursed Germans, yimach shemam, hayu shomrim b'kavdonus yisera, sha'al yigonav l'ghetto, shum mazon umichya. The Germans were very strict that no one could bring in any outside food into the ghetto. V'afal pikein, they never gave up hope. The residents of the ghetto never gave up hope that they would have matzah in the ghetto. They understood that the Nazis, their goal was to try to break the spirit of the Jewish people. They understood that if their spirit was broken, it would be easier for the Nazis to carry out their wicked plans. Yaakov, to wipe out the remnants of Yaakov b'nei Yisrael, to annihilate them. So they said, we understand, we can't let ourselves give up the hope to have matzah because that's just giving in to what the Nazis want. He says, because of this, it's the opposite of what we would have thought. We would have thought the people in the ghetto would have been so despondent, so depressed. He says, no, they never gave up the spirit. So that they wouldn't fall ensnared and trapped into the pit of despair. He says it was very important for the Jewish people that they shouldn't give up any of their Torah and any of their mitzvahs, because again, that would be succumbing to the Nazis and granting them a separate victory. They saw this, very interesting, they saw this as a rebellion against the Germans to perform the mitzvos. Harurim yimach shemam. Shegamru omer lahavi chas v'shalom kalila al beis Yisrael lachido mitachas shemei Hashem, who were trying to wipe out the Jewish people. Lezos, irganti b'chashai chabura ketani. He says, so because of this, I gathered together a secret group, a small group, shal anashim, ve'etalti aleihem l'chapes etzot v'tachbulos v'chdei l'hasid kemach l'afiyas matzos shenuchol l'kayim l'chol apachos mitzvos achila shal kezayis matzah, to figure out how to scheme and plot how we could get in the minimum amount of matzah to fulfill the mitzvah. Bein anshei achabur hazos haya echad b'shem Moshe Goldkorn Hashem yikam damo. There was one member of this group named Moshe Goldkorn. Hashem should avenge his blood. Mi Poland. He came from Poland. Shebarach me'arotzkim ha'germanim lulita. He ran from Poland to Lithuania. Ulam he tried to run away from the Nazis. Ulam hara hisigato. V'nichla b'yachan im ha'yehudim b'ghetto kovno. Unfortunately, the evil caught up with him in the Kovno ghetto. Aisha zeh avad b'yordan brigada. He was a member of the Jordan Brigade, one of the groups of people who the Nazis would take out a labor force. B'makom avodoso. Hayyachol lavo b'maga im goyim litaim ulasik mehem kemach halaf chafatzim shonim. That since he was a member of this brigade, this workforce, the Germans allowed him out of the ghetto, and he was able to interact with the Lithuanian Gentiles. And because of this, they were able to barter certain things for food. So, Ella v'kotzba, Aliyah v'kotzba, ki iev shar haya lahachnis esakemach l'toch ha-ghetto, mipnei ha-shmira ha-germanit, ha-chazaka al-ghetto, leval yichonas l'ghetto lechem, tapuchei adama, o shum devar, achar michya saguf. So again, he had to try to sneak. It was impossible. There was a very strict watchman of the Nazis who were there to prevent people from bringing in sustenance and food into the ghetto. He took it upon himself with great sacrifice, mamish, really great sacrifice, lahasi kemach michutz ghetto, to attain this flour from outside the ghetto, lahachnis l'ghetto, ulamarot ha-sakana atzuma she-rachba alav. Hitzliach midei pam bepam. Despite all the dangers, every now and then he was able, he was successful, b'shuvo min avoda michutz ghetto, lahagniv, to stow away, to steal, me'at kemach, a little bit of flour, sheisig eitz al goyim halitaim, which he was able to procure from the Lithuanian Gentiles. L'simcha so harbe lo haya gavul al sha'al yado yizko yehudim l'kai mitzvah gedol azu shalchias matzah. This Moshe Goldkorn was so happy that he had the ability to provide his fellow Jews the opportunity to perform this mitzvah of achilas matzah. Hakemach hazesh hu higniv l'ghetto, hustar b'makom seser v'nishmar b'shmira me'ula leval yivol olo me'ein abisha. He was able to hide it, to stash it away in a secret place in order to prevent being caught. V'kach ola b'yado lahavi kima kima. He brought in, you know, little kernel by kernel. Kemach shehispik l'afias matzah ba'ad karv l'meya ish. Enough matzah to provide for 100 people. Sheyuchlu l'kayim matzah mitzvah achilas kezayis matzah. Also biyara chabura hanal b'mesiras nefesh mamish lafos es hamatzos b'block C. Apparently, in the block C, this particular part of the ghetto, they were able to have a secret oven where they were able to bake the matzah. Makom haklaina verkashtan. I'm not exactly sure what that means. Small workshop. Okay. Sha'afu sham es halechem avor kiluya hagetto. In this small hidden workshop, in a small hidden oven, they were able to bake 100 matzos for the mitzvah of achilas matzah. Right. So it's just a beautiful tshuva. So birshus, but he's not even at the question yet. Birshus minahaleha, excuse me for mispronouncing it, verkstatin, also bidei achabur lafos es hamatzos b'meshach shal asar yamim, over the course of 10 days, in this workstation, they were able to produce the matzah, afrei shatanur huchshar kedasu kedin. And it was a real kosher oven. Vikr Baal Simcha, and who is the Iker, who is the happiest of them all? Haya Ha'ish Hanal was this Moshe Goldkorn who had sacrificed so much to bring in the flour into the ghetto. Al Sha'ala Biyadu L'Kayim B'Nafsho Yavi Lachmo. To fulfill what it says, B'Nafsho Yavi Lachmo, with his soul, he will provide, he will bring forth the bread. Lechem Oni, it was really Lechem Oni, afflicted man's bread. Lo rak bishvilo, ela gam bishvil od Yehudim. Again, his happiness wasn't because he could perform the mitzvah, but it was because he was enabled all the rest of the Jews to have a chance to perform this mitzvah, luzchusam b'mitzvah gedola, with such a great mitzvah. Al apam v'chamasam shal atzrorim ha-germanim yimach shemo, simchaso haisa gedola v'rabba. And it was in the face of the Germans, that's what made his simcha even greater, that it was an act of rebellion, of really showing the Germans that he wasn't willing to give up. Ki hir gish ki'ilu hu kayim b'mesiris nafsho, Mashuhuva Biramag, the Shulchan Aruch Simin Shin Chav Tes, in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, that which it says, Umina Gliknos Chitim, Ulechalkan Laniyim, Litzorach Pesach. There's a mitzvah before Pesach of Kimcha de Pischa, Mos Chitim, of being able to provide for the poor enough matzah and enough food for Pesach. He said, this is the ultimate way to fulfill that mitzvah. Ubeis Tsaru Mitzuka Kazos, Be'emez Zu Haisa Mitzvah Gedola Ad Ma'od. He said, it was such a great mitzvah, Shekayim Ha'ish, that this Moshe Goldkorn was able to do. Viseitu Asharos L'Rabim L'Kayim Sachag Hacherus Kalocha. Right? Imagine he's calling the Chag Hacherus, the Chag of freedom, even in the ghetto, even in the abject poverty and despair of the ghetto, it was really a holiday of freedom. Ulafiach b'hem tikva she'od yizku l'kayim es Chag b'ditza v'chedva l'achar usam es ma'palas hager manim, and it gave them the hope that one day they would be able to fulfill the mitzvah in happiness and rejoicing at the fall of the Germans and the Nazis. Ulam, however, ulamar behatzar yomayim. A few days before the holiday of Pesach, b'shuva ish me'avodaso ba'erev, when Moshe Goldkorn was returning home, hu ne'atzar al yidei ha'shomrim ha'germanim lifnei yichneso l'ghetto. As he was coming back into the ghetto, he was stopped. He was stopped by the Nazis. Him chivsu chipus medukdak. They did a very exact search b'bigadav, in his clothing and his garments. Umatzu etzlo sakit katan shel kemach, a small little bag, a sack of flour. Kishahim ra'u also bekil kalto, sha'al af hatzav hachamur shelahem, leval yuval ghetto shum mitzorech mazon. They saw that he was violating this principle. You can't bring any food into the ghetto. Hu echin v'nafshu labor al hatzav hazen. He was violating. He was trying to violate their laws. Behavi also kemach michutz l'ghetto, miyad hitchilu lahafli lo makos. They began to beat him mercilessly. Heim hiku upatsu v'salu b'chol gufo. And they beat him. They beat him to a pulp. Heim shivru lo as kol shinov. They knocked out all of his teeth. Laman yiru v'yiru, in order that people should see and be afraid. V'lo yizidun la'asos kein kamo, to make a lesson out of him, that no one else should ever try to sneak food into the ghetto. Aval ha'ish kibel yisura be'ahava. But this Moshe Goldkorn, he accepted his terrible pains with love. Ki gedola ha'isa simchaso kamar, because he knew that it's going to be Pesach, and he still was the one who provided the matzah for the Jewish people. But then here's the question. Again, this whole story builds up to this question. V'azba ha'ish lefanai. And now this Moshe Roshri says, this man, Moshe Goldkorn, came to me. V'nafsho lishol higia. He was asking with all his soul, b'dvaro huga b'dchia gedola ketino. He was crying like a baby. Again, we can't even fathom this question. Eich yuchal l'kai mitzvos achilas k'zayis matzah k'sheshinav shivuros. How can he eat the matzah if his teeth have been bashed in and they're broken? V'inu yochol lilos b'hen. He can't chew the matzah. Because it's so painful. So you'll say, maybe dip the matzah in some water and soften the matzah. He says, he didn't want to do this. Moshe Goldkorn refused to dip the matzah in water to make it softer. Why? He was chassidish. Right? He wouldn't eat kebrachs. Can we imagine, can we even fathom what it means? Here he is in the ghetto. He's given all his life to sneak in all of this flour to make the matzah. And he's worried, he's not worried about a halacha, he's worried about a minhag, of keeping the minhag of his forefathers that go all the way back to the Baal Shem Tov, to not eat gebrachs, to not eat matzah soaked in water.
What? This is an emergency. This is not
So we think it's an emergency, but we see the connection. Again, the first question we saw, that's a halacha question. But here, to think that they were still so concerned with the minhag, because again, they saw this as a rebellion to the Germans, that chas v'shalom, the Germans can kill us, they can beat us mercilessly, but they're not going to take the Torah, they're not going to take the mitzvos away from us. And this was his question. And look at the answer. V'akshav, im kol mesiros nafsho biglav mitzvos achilas matzah, hu atzmo lo yuchal l'kayma. He put in so much effort and now he's not going to be able to fulfill it. U'lizos nafsho b'sheiloso, eichev shar l'sader, shagam hu yuchal l'zakos, l'izkos b'kiyam mitzvos achilas k'zayis matzah. He says, please, Rav Oshri, tell me, how am I going to fulfill the mitzvah? So again, we'll just go back to the English, because here in the Hebrew, he goes through a whole very exact halachic discussion with all of the meforshim and all the poskim. But if you turn back to his response in the English, it's a very interesting tshuva that he writes. He says, the tradition of not soaking matzah is, it's on page 2, or page 53 in the English. I don't believe he was Hasidish. I believe he was a Lithuanian Rav.
There was a Rav Oshri in Israel. I wonder if he was
a Rav. Oh, could be.
I wonder why he didn't go to a Hasidish.
Because again, I don't think he was the posek. He was the one who was really paskening, answering all the shilohs. It's actually an interesting story. They write, I don't remember if it was in the back of this book, the English responsa, they say that Rav Oshri was actually, luck would have it, the Nazis assigned him a job, that he was supposed to be the custodian in a particular building. That was his job. He was in the labor force, and he was supposed to clean out a building every day. And one day he noticed that there was a bunch of boxes that had come into this building that they had the Nazis had brought in. Apparently they were turning this building, they wanted to turn it into a museum of the history of Jewish people. They had found some Sfarim, and they thought it would be appropriate in their museum after they wiped out the Jews, and they built this museum of the Jewish people, the extinct Jewish people, to have some of the relics of the Jewish people from their past. So they brought in some Sfarim.
Why would the Nazis want to do that?
It's a big crowd. All the shuls
turned to show it's a sign of, look who we beat. We destroyed them, we wiped them out, and this is who they used to be. It was a sign of pride, that this is the people that we beat, right? If we conquered the Jewish people, just so people would think, you know, if they totally wiped them out and there was never any remnant, any recollection that there was a Jewish people, so how could they boast to future generations that we were the Aryan race who wiped out the Jewish people?
Exactly.
And so as luck would have it, Rav Oshri had access to some Sfarim that they had brought in, some halachic Sfarim, so it could be that he had the most access to halachic Sfarim in the ghetto. But he writes, the tradition of not soaking matzah is a stringency, it's a chumrah. Halacha does not forbid soaking matzah. I allowed the questioner to soak the matzah in water, even though he was descended from Hasidim, whose custom was not to eat soaked matzah on Pesach, because he had no other way of fulfilling the mitzvah, a mitzvah for which he had risked his life. But listen to this. I did, however, instruct him to obtain permission from a Beis Din to do a Hataras Nedarim of three people, which would annul the implicit vow of the tradition of his forebears that he had upheld all his life, not to eat soaked matzah on Pesach. So again, Rav Oshri was still concerned, the Hasidish man, Moshe Goldkorn, was concerned with keeping the traditions of his forefathers. And Rav Oshri says, listen, I understand what you're trying to do here, but As you said, that the halacha in this case would have to say there's no other option. This is the pressing times, and we have to allow you to eat this matzah even if it's soaked in water. But still, we still give legitimacy to your minhag, so much so that you have to do a hataras nedarim. You have to find the Beis Din to annul your vow to allow you to eat this matzah. Yes?
I think this is beautiful because I think also there was an element of the Rav easing his psychological torment.
Ah.
By having him go through this official Hataras Nedarim, and that would allow him to have peace.
Exactly. Right, so that's a beautiful way of putting it, meaning that he still understands that it's a halachic, there's a halachic ramifications for what he's doing. He's violating a minhag of his forefathers. But if he does a Hataras Nedarim, so that gets him off the hook, it allows him...
It wasn't necessary, but it...
Right.
But he needed
it. So it's a psychological, and that's really the beauty of the Sefer, of the response from the Holocaust. You see, Rav Oshri is so attuned to a lot of the psychology involved behind every question. He says there's an interesting question whether or not, again, we can't even fathom some of these questions. They were taking some of the prisoners away, and who knows where they were taking them. Perhaps they were taking them to their death. And they would make the other Jewish people stand in lines to watch their brothers be taken away. And they wanted to know, the people who were there asked Rav Oshri, who were standing online, that they wanted to know if they could say Shalom Aleichem, to give some chizik, to give some strength to their brothers and sisters who were being led away. They weren't allowed to say anything, the Nazis wouldn't allow them to say anything, a long sentence or really anything, but they figured if they could just mutter a Shalom Aleichem. I think they thought it would give them chizik. So the question was, again, they were so attuned to halacha that there is a discussion that the word shalom...
Why is that a question?
So the word shalom, according to Chazal, is actually one of the names of God.
What?
Shalom is one of, a very deep, perhaps Kabbalistic idea, but they were so attuned that the word shalom is the name of God, and here they were standing in a line without their hat, without their kippah. And they wanted to know, could they say shalom? We can't fathom the question.
That they even asked such questions.
But they were so sensitive. This is the world we're talking about. They were so sensitive to saying even shalom without wearing a kippah or a hat to give chizik to their brothers. And the Rav Oshri, again, you see the psychology, says it's true that maybe shalom is the name of God, but think of the chizik. Think of the people who are walking away with the Nazis. Who knows where they're going? And the amount of chizik that it would give them. So you're right, maybe it's not a strict matter of the law. So again, but you see in each tshuva there's such deep psychology behind it. It's really a worthwhile read. Yes?
That was all they had left. Was they couldn't do the halachas properly, if at all. And they didn't have things, and they didn't bodies pretty much, but that's what they all had. They only had their psyche left.
Right. And you read through these questions and you cry, and you read through the answers and you cry, and it's just such a beautiful, beautiful work. Just to see again the connection to the Torah, a real pillar of Torah Rav Oshri, and what a beautiful pillar that was to just keep people connected to the Torah. And you see the connection people had without him, but just the ability to answer the Shilos and to have the sense of mind to even write down the question just so to save for posterity, so we can see after the horrors of the Holocaust how people were so connected to the Torah and to mitzvah. So that's the pillar of Torah. I would like to talk about Rav Ephraim Oshri, really a very inspirational figure. Just again, I implore you really, if you could get your hands on the Sefer, it's really a must read. So moving from Torah to Avodah, we're told, what is the Avodah? Avodah Shebelev is keeping the hearts of the Jewish people strong. And again, another Sefer, which you really have to, you know, I would say if you were a Hasidish Yid, you would have to go to the mikvah first before you can even think about opening. It's such a holy sefer, and such a you just shudder to read some of the sefers. The sefer called the Eish Kodesh, written by Rav Kolonimus Kalman Shapiro, the Pia Zesner Rebbe. Now the Pia Zesner Rebbe is one of the most fascinating figures in the Holocaust. He was born in 1889 to a very distinguished family of Hasidish Rebbes. And already at the age of 20, he assumed the role of the Rebbe of Pia Zesner. Now, in the pre-war Europe, to become a Rebbe at age 20, that was basically, it was unheard of. It was really, you had to be a Yotze Min HaKlal, really someone who was so connected to the people, a genius. And that was the Pia Zesner Rebbe. And he established one of the largest Hasidic yeshivas at the time. Pia Zesner was right outside of Warsaw, and he had hundreds of very young Talmidim. In fact, I believe right now, Rabbi Linzer is talking about education in a different room. I think he's going to be quoting some of the Pia Zesner's work. The only work that was published before the Holocaust of the Pia Zesner, it was a sefer called Chovos HaTalmidim, The Student's Obligation. It's really is really a beautiful work in the art of pedagogy, of teaching students. And till this day, people use that as a workbook or as a guide to how to be an effective teacher. This was already written before the war. He was just a very special Rebbe, really connected to the downtrodden, and he really strived to create a Hasidus, have some students who are really elite Hasidim. And you see in his writings that he has diaries and he has works written to students, young students, older students. He really wants them to tap into their potential. Now, during the war, he was in the Warsaw Ghetto, and he also became, Rav Oshri was the Rav in the Kovno Ghetto. Rav Shapiro was the Rav of the Warsaw, the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto. And while he was in the ghetto, he delivered drushos. He delivered sermon speeches, motivational works, and they were compiled into the Sefer Eish Kodesh, a sacred fire, a holy fire, and an unbelievable story similar to Rav Oshri. The Pia Zesner wrote down these works, and this work, another work called Tzav Zeruz, which I have the translation, it was translated into a book called To Heal the Soul. This was his diary, his spiritual diary, and he hid them in the Warsaw Ghetto. They were found in the 50s as people were rebuilding Warsaw, and there was a note. And the Rebbe had written a note saying, please, whoever finds these works, please send them to Eretz Yisrael, to my family in Eretz Yisrael, and publish them. And he told them what to write as an inscription, and they even have a photocopy. I was going to photocopy, but it's just very hard to see. They have the photocopy of the actual letter that was found with the manuscripts. And it's just an unbelievable, unbelievable theological work, the Eish Kodesh. So, just to get a glimpse into his own personal life, I first photocopied a portion of his diary, the Tzav Viziros. So this was really one of the last Tzav Viziros. You'll have it in the Hebrew, and the title will be on top right after the English. So we're on page 5. Or it's 5 numbered in the circle on the bottom, and page 116 from the book To Heal the Soul. Again, the translation of Tzav Zeruz.
Page 5.
Yes, there's on the bottom. I hand wrote the number 5. It should come right after the Hebrew of Rav Oshri. So again, we don't really have time.
My son, where are you?
So I wish we had a little more time. Again, I said we could spend months. Just focusing in on each figure, but we're already running out of time. So he writes in here one of his very last diary entries in the Warsaw Ghetto. His son had been sick. His only son, he had a son and a daughter. This was his only son, the one who was supposed to take over after his father, and who he had invested so much time and love into this son. And his son had been sick, And then it was miraculously cured. And then unfortunately, there was a bombing. The Germans had bombed Warsaw, and his son was injured. And while his son was injured in the hospital, his son's wife, his daughter-in-law, his beloved daughter-in-law was standing outside the hospital. And again, the Germans bombed the city and killed his son's wife, his beloved daughter-in-law, and his and other members of his family. And then a few days later, his son passed away. And it was really, he was just, you see in his diary how broken the Piazesna Rebbe was. And again, we don't have time to read it inside, but just to give you a glimpse into his own personal life, how broken he was, but yet how connected to God he was. He prays. He prays at the very end of that piece. We'll skip to the, if you just turn the page, he offers a prayer. May have mercy from now on, God, on each of us and on the Jewish people. Grant us only good things from now on. May I myself be included with all my family and friends among the Jewish people to receive your kindness. Grant us right now the eternal redemption, rebirth of the dead, and a complete physical and spiritual salvation. He was so concerned with the spiritual salvation of his Jewish brethren that after the death of his son, he solely devoted himself to the Jews who were living in the Warsaw Ghetto. And these were the drashos that he gave over in the Warsaw Ghetto. Again, you have it after the English, you have it in Hebrew. Again, the beautiful original wording of the Piazesna Rebbe in Tzav Vezirus. But I'd just like to read one of the short drushes that he gave over in the Warsaw Ghetto. So I was reading from the end of the Tzav Vezirus. Just that last paragraph is on page 6, and where I wrote 6, or 118 in the translation. But if you skip over after the Hebrew, the original, so we have a beautiful work, also a translation and an analysis of the Eish Kodesh, a book called The Holy Fire, written by Nehemiah Polin, which is, again, he goes through the themes of the Eish Kodesh, really a beautiful work if you want to be able to follow through just the theology and the belief of the Piazesna Rebbe. But here he has a translation of the piece I'm going to read in Hebrew, so you'll see there, if you want to follow in English, where there's an arrow on the left-hand side, or if you turn the page to a speech, a short little drasha that he gave on Purim. So now it's on page 9, and there's Hebrew, it says on top, Eish Kodesh, and it says Lepurim. So the Rebbe quotes, he says, Isa b'tikune Zohar, that Shepurim ki Yom HaKippurim, a famous saying in the Zohar, that Purim and Yom Kippur are very similar. Yom Kippurim, Yom Kippur is like Purim. So again, these are the drushes that he's giving over to his followers and even those who had picked him up to be the Rebbe while he was in the Warsaw Ghetto. Ef shar merames gam lezeh. Shekemo Yom HaKippurim, Hatanis Vachuva B'Yom Zeh, Lo Imrotza Osam HaAdam LaSosam Osa. When it comes to Yom Kippur, he says, we don't have a choice. When it comes to fasting on Yom Kippur and doing tshuva on Yom Kippur, all Jews, it doesn't matter, people are connected to Yom Kippur, whether we want to or not, we try to fast, we do tshuva on Yom Kippur. Rak Bein Imrotza Bein Lo, Mekayim Ipnei Gzeres HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We do it because that was the Gzera of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because that was the decree of God. So he says an unbelievable lesson. He says to his followers, Kein gam simchas purim, lo rak im ha'adam me'atzmo b'simcha, o al kopan b'matzav sheyochol l'sameach es atzmo, tzarechu l'sameach. He says, don't think that Purim, a holiday of joy, we celebrate only when we have the ability to be in joy and when we're actually happy. Rak gam imhu b'shiflus u'b'shviras lev. Even we, who are so broken, so brokenhearted, so downtrodden, Hamoach v'chol rucho nirmas, our spirit has been crushed. Cho kush etzerach al kopanim eza nitzutz shol simcha lehachnis haliba. We have to find that spark of simcha. Imagine this drush in the Warsaw Ghetto. The Rebbe gets up and says, it doesn't matter if we want to or not, we have to celebrate the holiday of Purim b'simcha. V'chei mimala lemata, and so too will be from above to below. Kemo sheyom hakipurim itzumo shel yom mechaper. There's an idea on Yom Kippur that the itzumo, the holiday itself, the day itself, has the ability to heal, to remove the sin, to be mechaper, to annul the sin. V'afilu im lo hishlim kol tshuva, so even if one didn't complete his tshuva, Omer Rebbe shemechaper lo. The opinion of Rebbe in the Gemara is that that he still gets kapara, that one still gets kapara, even if they couldn't complete their tshuva. Kein gam bepurim, af shelo haya ha'ish ha'yisraeli besimcha kefish etzarach. Even if we don't have the ability here in the Warsaw Ghetto to be as besimcha, to be as happy and rejoicing as we can, shetzarach lios as we should, Umemela kol avodaso shebepurim lo haisa bishleimus. And we see that the person feels that they can't even celebrate the holiday of Purim as they used to, with Shleimus in its completion, mikol makom. Still in all, he says, Hayeshua v'asimcha shapurim poel al Yisrael, gam ata poel v'osa. That we'll see that the simcha of Purim, just like Yom Kippur, the itzumo shel yom, the day itself, will bring with the tshuva, so too on Purim, the day itself, will bring us to a level of simcha. Again, just a beautiful, uplifting message of avoda, of service, from the Pious Ezra Rebbe to his followers in the Warsaw Ghetto. Unfortunately, again, one of a tremendous Holocaust story. If you can read it in Esther Farbstein's book or in the notes in The Holy Fire, and there's a biography in the back of the Ish Kodesh. So the Pious Ezra Rebbe perished with his followers in the Chwaniki labor camp. And it's very interesting. He had numerous chances to escape. And they say that there was one of the partisan groups actually sent in into the labor camp. They would send in an agent to try to bring out one or two people at a time. And the Rebbe, he was totally committed to the Jewish people. And he made a pact in the labor camp. They have firsthand testimony that he had made a pact in the labor camp with some other 20 other people who were there, religious, non-religious, doctors, academics, Hasidim, Misnagdim, that none of them would leave, none of them would escape unless all of them could leave at the same time. And really, just to imagine what kind of pact that was, to be connected to all sorts of Jews in such a terrible time. They said they tried to get the Rebbe out and he refused. Because they were so connected to one another, they refused unless they could all go. None of them would go, and unfortunately, he was shot to death in the Troniki labor camp. So that's the avoda of the Ish Kodesh. Again, I really wish we had more time to get into the beautiful teachings of the Ish Kodesh. I put right after the piece in the Hebrew, in the Ish Kodesh, just a few pages from the book, The Holy Fire, where they discuss the faith, the notions of faith, if you can imagine, emunah, in such terrible times during the Holocaust, of the Pious Ezra Rebbe, from his writings. We definitely don't have time to do them now, but again, if you have some time afterwards, you can read through some of these essays. So that was Torah, that was the Torah of Rav Oshri, the avod of the Pious Ezra Rebbe, and just to finish up the lecture with the Gemilus Chasadim of the Kloisenberger Rebbe. The Kloisenberger Rebbe, Rav Yekusiel Yehuda Halberstam, was a descendant of the Divrei Chaim, Rav Chaim Sanzer, one of the foremost leading Hasidish halachic authorities in the history of Hasidus. So the Kloisenberger of Yekusiel Yehuda Halberstam also became a Rebbe at an extremely young age, in 22. He was born in 1905, and he lived in Hungary. We know that the war didn't reach Hungary till much later on, till 1944. And it's unbelievable. He became the Rebbe at the age of 22. In 1937, he was offered a position at a very young age to sit on the Beis Din in Yerushalayim, to the rabbinical court in Yerushalayim. He was so young that he didn't know whether he should take the job. He actually wrote a letter to his mother. And his mother said, what do you need it for? You're so young, you're not ready yet to assume the role in the Beis Din in Yerushalayim. You should stay put. Unfortunately, he stayed put. His wife and 11 children were murdered by the Nazis in the concentration camp. And he too, like the Pious Ezra, stayed with his flock. He stayed with his Hasidim. He was in Auschwitz. Unbelievable stories. If you have the opportunity to get your hands on the book, The Kloisenberger Rebbe, The War Years. It's just a tremendous lesson in chizuk. We can't even fathom what the Rebbe put himself through. And it just, it's mind-boggling. He never, while he was in the concentration camp, they had a rule, you had to shave your beard. But he refused to use a razor. It's halachically forbidden to use a razor to shave his beard. So he created a disguise, a ruse, where he wrapped his beard as if he had a toothache. And for months, he went around, he never shaved his beard until he could get his hands on an electric razor, which was halachically permissible. He refused to eat anything that was cooked by a non-Jew because it violated Bishul Akum. He refused to eat anything that wasn't kosher. He told his followers they had to eat. So what did he eat? He made do with it. We can't even imagine. It seems like a miracle that he was even able to survive just with whatever food he could get his hands on. But really,
is that almost like a negative, because he's not giving an example to his followers that they have to, choose life.
Right, so he would tell his followers they had to choose life. But again, like Rav Oshri was writing, that the Nazis were trying, he felt that the Nazis were trying to break the, besides the physical spirit, they're also trying to break the spiritual spirit of the Jewish people. And he felt, again, it's very rooted in Hasidus, that the Rebbe has to serve as the paradigm. Mm-hmm. That he had to serve as the paradigm of someone who wouldn't be broken by the Nazis. Again, we could talk about whether or not it was a good idea, bad idea. But certainly we see the Kedusha, the holiness of the Rebbe. And that holiness really manifested itself. Again, we're running out of time. We have about a minute left. It really manifested itself after the war. After the war in the DP camps, I heard firsthand this past Pesach. Again, I had a unique opportunity to take time to talk to somebody who survived the war. And I asked him if he knew the Klosenberger Rebbe. And he told me some of the speeches at the Klosenberger Rebbe. He said, yes, he knew him. He was in the DP camp with the Rebbe. And he told me some of the motivating speeches that the Klosenberger Rebbe gave to bring a ruach, to bring a spirit to those who had survived. And that was the chesed, the ultimate chesed, to take the downtrodden, to take those who were so broken, and to bring them back to life. Again, we're out of time, but it's really unbelievable. If you just read some of the stories, just a beautiful story at the end, I photocopied from this book, on the very last page, was the Yom Kippur of 1946, it was approaching. On page 211, it should be the very last page in the packet. As Yom Kippur of 1946 approached, Mrs. Abraham, the principal of the girls' school, he set up a girls' school in the DP camp. So he came to the Rebbe with a request. Isn't every Jewish girl entitled to a blessing from her father on Erev Yom Kippur? Why should these girls have less just because they are orphans? The Rebbe was very moved and he acceded to the request. Even though it was just before Kol Nidre, one of the holiest moments of the year, when the Rebbe was normally enveloped in such fear of the Almighty that people were afraid to approach him, he instructed Mrs. Abraham to have all the girls approach the window of his room. Placing his hands covered by a scarf on the head of each girl, the Rebbe emotionally blessed each one in the memory of the holy souls who had perished in the Holocaust. Tears streamed down every face. So it's just a beautiful lesson of chesed, of rebuilding those shattered souls who had survived the Holocaust. So again, we have the three heroes, three among many heroes of the Holocaust who represent the three pillars of the world. Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam omed ala Torah, ala voda, it's really in the times when the world is falling apart that we need to have the pillars. When everything is going fine, so you know, a pillar is nice, it's there for decorative purposes. But it's really when the world is going through upheaval that we really need those pillars, these rabbinic heroes of the Holocaust, to really serve as the pillars to hold up the world. Thank you very much.